Welcome to the Sunstone Podcast, everyone, where there is always more than one way to Mormon. I'm Stephen Carter, and I'm here to introduce this week's episode. One of the biggest turning points of my intellectual and spiritual life was when I was persuaded by the sociology of knowledge that we tend to believe what the people we interact with most believe. The more I thought about how I came to my own beliefs and how they've shifted, the more sense it made. And that was disconcerting because, you know, I thought I'd developed my own beliefs and that they were pretty spot on. It made me realize how difficult it is to approach an idea or a belief objectively. Today's episode introduces some more of these disconcerting ideas from the field of social psychology. Peter Levitt is the presenter. He is a social psychologist and an assistant professor of psychology at Indiana State University. His research interests include the psychology of social class and intergroup contact and communication. This episode was recorded at the 2018 Sunstone Summer Symposium.
I was born and raised in Mormon in Western Canada. I come from a long line of Mormons, went to a very Mormon high school, served a full-time mission, considered myself very devoutly Mormon for most of my young adulthood. I got married in the temple. Point of all that is that I took Mormonism very, very seriously for a large part of my life. But in addition to all of that, I also had some experiences that made me experience Mormonism a little differently. In my mid-20s, my dad came out as gay. Later on, I moved to California just in time for Proposition 8 to begin, which was a big catalyst for my change in beliefs. I started a graduate program in social psychology, ended up getting divorced, and ultimately I left the church. I now consider myself an ex-Mormon. But importantly, Mormon is still a very important part of my identity. My immediate family has all also left the church and has pursued different kinds of belief systems, and I continue to have many friends and family members who are very devoutly Mormon and who are of all sorts of other kinds of belief systems. So I have a very, I think, very diverse tapestry. I wanted to just get us thinking about some of the hard-to-understand differences, some of the things about which it's hard to feel compassion, hard to feel understanding for different kinds of Mormons. People look at the same scripture or read the same excerpt from a conference talk and interpret it very differently and use it to guide their behavior in very different ways. And this is something that's often difficult to understand. Receptiveness to true information. This is something that I see all the time. Is everybody thinks that they have the objective facts and that other people, when exposed to those facts, should respond the way that they did, right? And it's often difficult to understand why they don't. Indifference to or willingness to harm. So common topics in kind of Mormon life is what kinds of behaviors are good or bad, what kinds of behaviors are harmful to our friends and family members and loved ones, and how do people respond to that? And I think there's often a perception that people are indifferent to or even willing to harm other people in the name of their beliefs, and that's often very difficult to understand. And then a general theme that comes up is hypocrisy, so people who claim to believe one thing and do another thing, something that I think is a very common experience and observation for people. Now, I want you to think about how do we often explain these kinds of differences. So when we come across somebody who believes very differently than us, when we come across somebody who seems indifferent to harm, when we come across somebody who does not immediately change their mind in response to this accurate information that we've shared, how do we often explain those kinds of differences? We rationalize it in a very self-serving way, and we explain it as kind of, they're not as smart as I am, or something along those lines. If they knew what I knew, they would think how I think. So this belief that exposure to information should have the same effect on everybody, sort of thing. Brainwashed is a common explanation that I see lobbed about a lot. And what these explanations have in common is they're very simple. They're very limited explanations for the kinds of behavior that we find difficult to understand. And what I'm hoping to do today is give you some reasons to look beyond those explanations, so to complicate the way that you think about these differences in belief, differences in behavior, so that we don't rely so heavily on those oversimplified explanations. So we're not so quick to just say somebody who believes this is crazy or dumb or evil or anything like that. I want us to rely less on those kinds of explanations and have a little more complexity in it. I could sum up the whole gist of my talk in this statement by Elliot Aronson, the social psychologist, calls Aronson's first law. People who do crazy things are not necessarily crazy. This applies to kind of the other thing. People who do dumb things are not necessarily dumb. People who do evil things are not necessarily evil. And I think this is a really important idea. So my main thesis, the main points I want to get across are, one, that compassion and understanding is hard. One big reason that compassion is hard is because people sometimes hurt us and hurt the people that we care about. What I'm going to focus on is the misunderstanding component. We find it hard to feel compassion because we misunderstand each other. We misunderstand each other's motives and reasons for engaging in behavior. We ascribe evil or oversimplified motives to other people's behavior. Compassion and understanding, while difficult, can be easier if we understand more about the social and psychological motives underlying our own and other people's beliefs and behavior. I want it to be treated as kind of a toolkit, a psychological toolkit that we can go to when we're feeling confused, when we have trouble feeling positively towards other people. I also want to make it clear that nothing that I share today excuses wrongdoing or undoes harm that happens. So across differences in Mormonism, harm often happens. People do bad things. Nothing that I explain here today excuses or undoes that. I want to make that absolutely clear. Very basically, just quick intro to social psychology. We study how people's thoughts, feelings, and behaviors are influenced by the presence of other people. So it really hinges on this idea that we are social creatures, that we live in social spaces, that the social beings that we share space with matter a lot to us. Some of these fundamental ideas include the notion that any given behavior is the product, is a function of the person and the environment that they're in. Right? And this is a fairly straightforward idea, but it's an idea that I don't think we often think about in very nuanced ways when we're trying to explain other people's behavior. We are motivated by belonging. We're motivated by having accurate knowledge about the world and about the people in it. Control, a need to matter, and to have trust for the people that we share this world with. Some examples from social psychology research is one very well-studied phenomenon is that when we judge other people's behavior and we're making what's called attributions or explanations for that behavior, we tend to overestimate the role of the person and underestimate the role of the environment. So when we judge somebody else's behavior, it's they did that thing because they're a certain kind of person. So that's often the kind of explanation we resort to. And that leads to this kind of crazy, dumb, evil explanations for people's behavior. It's they did this dumb thing because they're a dumb person. And it's not to say that there's not some part of the person, some personality or something like that, that contributes to that behavior. But the point is that we overestimate how much that plays a role in the behavior. And we underestimate environmental or situational factors. Another thing to remember, and this was brought up in one of the comments, is that we tend to attribute behavior in ways that are self-serving. So, for example, research shows that when we're explaining our own behavior, if our behavior had good results, then it's because I'm a good person. If my behavior had bad results, it's because there was something about the environment that affected my performance. Something about the environment made me perform badly or behave badly or something like that. So, and you can see how this could apply to when we judge other people as well. So we want to, depending on how we feel about another person, we might explain their behavior in different ways that are consistent with how we feel. So somebody did something, somebody that we dislike, engaged in a behavior that was bad because they're a bad person. So, like that kind of thinking. Another important reason why this person-environment interaction is important to understand is that when we want to fix problems, and I think a lot of us in this room are probably kind of the problem solvers, we're aware of issues in Mormonism, issues that arise from differences in belief, and we want to fix those. But it's important when we try to fix those that we know what the source of the problem is. Is it the person that's the source of the problem, or is it the situation that they're in, the environment that they're a part of, that's the problem? And that affects where we target interventions, how we solve problems, and so on. And so that's another very important reason why I think this person-environment interaction is important. What I want to talk about now is the motives that often underlie a lot of our behavior, these fundamental social motives. The first one is a big one, the motive to belong. Because we are social creatures, because we live in and among other people, and other people matter a lot for how our lives go, how we feel, we tend to care a lot about feeling like we belong and avoiding a sense of rejection. And what I want to share is just, a couple of examples of research that illustrate how easy it is for us to form groups and how quickly those groups become important to us. So in a classic social psychology study, researchers asked research participants to rate a series of paintings by Paul Klee or Vasily Kandinsky. After they rated the paintings, they were arbitrarily assigned to two groups. So unrelated to how they rated the paintings, they were either Klee people or Kandinsky people. And that arbitrary distinction made by the researcher was enough for those research participants to develop a social identity related to the kind of painting that they apparently have an affinity for. And they started to treat members of their own group more favorably and treat members of the other group less favorably. So this in-lab situation, an arbitrary group distinction, led to changes in thoughts and behavior. So it happens very, very simply. And so you can imagine how when the groups are more important, when they're less arbitrary, like our religious identities, for example, where we stand in Mormonism, for example, that these groups are very likely to influence our thoughts and behavior towards ourselves, our own groups, and towards other groups, right? The other aspect I want to talk about is the fear of rejection, so not belonging, and how motivating that is. This image right here is a research tool called Cyberball. It's a very simple but very effective manipulation of ostracism. What happens is it's just a computerized game. You can see the participant's hand, so the research participant is that hand controls that hand. And then the three figures on the screen will pass the ball to each other. And at the beginning of the experiment, everyone more or less gets the ball the same number of times. But in the ostracism condition, so when they want the participant to feel rejected, the two cartoon figures there will just start passing the ball to each other and ignoring the participant. And as simple and silly as that sounds, it reliably results in feelings of rejection on participants. So it comes very naturally. We're very sensitive to being rejected. It's very aversive. We don't like feeling rejected. And so we do a lot of behaviors that help us feel belonging, and avoid rejection. And this is true not only for groups that we care a lot about, like, for example, our Mormon identities, our Mormon groups, but also even for groups that we dislike. One study looked at rejection by KKK members. So even when people were rejected in this game by supposed KKK members, you still felt the sting of rejection by being excluded, even by groups that you don't like. So that's how powerful this motive is to belong and avoid rejection. The next social motive I want to talk about is this desire for accurate knowledge. So accurate knowledge about the world in general, accurate knowledge about the people in that world, accurate knowledge about ourselves as actors in this world. We develop these frameworks for understanding ourselves in the world. And one way that we achieve this need for accurate knowledge is by interpreting the world in terms that we're already familiar with, in terms that already make sense to us. And you probably are familiar with the term confirmation bias, which refers to the tendency to seek out and interpret information that's already consistent with our pre-existing beliefs, right? I think a lot of us, we think about accurate knowledge. That means objective consideration of all the facts, right? But no, we can satisfy that need for accurate knowledge by seeking information in a way that allows us to believe that we have accurate and complete knowledge about the world. Also, interpreting the same knowledge in different ways. This was a fascinating example from after the Obama-Romney debate leading up to the 2012 election. These showed up right next to each other on my Facebook feed, and I thought it was too perfect. They both use the same eating metaphor as well, so one candidate ate the other up. But this is an example of two people being exposed to exactly the same information and coming away from it with exactly opposite interpretations. And so this is, again, this satisfies this need for accurate knowledge. So when you're watching this, when you're consuming this information, if you interpret it in a certain way, you can maintain that belief that you have an accurate sense of knowledge, a good grasp of how the world works. And in general, that's true of all of us, right? We want to believe that we have accurate knowledge about the world. We want to believe that we have accurate knowledge about ourselves. And that influences a whole bunch of behavior. And there are lots of ways that this can play out in Mormon experiences. So, for example, you can imagine there are lots of Mormons for whom it is very important, very central to their identity, that they are nice, caring people, right? And so in situations where they end up behaving in a way that's not nice or caring, or when another Mormon, someone they care about, behaves in a way that's not nice or caring, one of the options is to admit that what you believe about yourself or about the group that you value is wrong, or you can adjust your cognition so that the victim of that harm or not nice behavior somehow deserved it. It was justified in some way, right? Some other examples from Mormon experiences that I think are useful to think about. My mission was really stressful and difficult in a lot of ways. I mean, I look back on it and I can see the value in it. But also, what would it mean to look back on my mission and admit that it was actually a waste of 2 years, right? So I am motivated to think more positively about that experience so that I don't feel like I did something stupid, right? Not to say, and again, not to say that none of my feelings about my mission are genuine. I think I did learn a lot from my mission. But the point is that I'm motivated to think that there are good things about my mission because of how difficult it was, because of the commitment that was involved. And another thing that I want to share about kind of my ex-Mormon identity is that leaving the church was incredibly stressful and came at a huge social cost. And so because of that, because I made this choice that had these huge consequences, I am highly motivated to think that I made a good choice. I am highly motivated to believe that leaving the church was the best decision, and there are all these positive aspects about leaving the church. I am highly motivated to think that the church is awful and evil and the worst thing ever, and so it's a good thing I left it, right? So I am motivated to think this way because it helps maintain my perception of myself as someone who has accurate knowledge about the world, about myself, and who behaves in accordance with those kinds of beliefs. Control is so important to us. We're so motivated by having a sense of control or feeling like we have a sense of control that when we don't, either when we perceive that we don't or when we actually don't, it has huge negative health consequences, mental health, physical health consequences. And in situations where nothing we do seems to change outcomes, we can often develop this sense of learned helplessness where we internalize the fact that we seem not to be able to do anything to change our circumstance, and that changes our behavior and attitudes dramatically and negatively impacts our health. We want control so badly that we often engage in a lot of behavior that gives us illusory control over outcomes in our lives. So some simple, kind of relatively trivial research shows that people who chose their own lottery numbers feel more committed to that lottery ticket than people for whom the numbers were chosen for them. So our ability to choose those numbers gives us a sense of control. Some people believe that shaking dice harder will have an outcome on the result of the roll, right? So we believe these things that give us illusory control because control is so motivating for us. And I think we can imagine some things in Mormonism that are connected to this. Like the way we feel about prayer and reading the scriptures and those kinds of things give us a sense of control. And it's a very important sense, right? Prayer, if you believe that it actually controls things, it is very useful. Psychologically, it's good for your kind of perceptions of yourself in the world. It's very helpful. So the point is, a sense of control is very, very motivating. The next social motive I want to talk about is the need to matter. And I think we can probably imagine some ways already that this applies to Mormon life, but I want to go through a few examples. Lots of research shows that people engage in lots of self-enhancement behaviors, so behaviors that make us feel more important, that make us feel good about ourselves and like we're part of something important, than we're important relative to other people. Studies of Facebook and Instagram, and I'm sure your own subjective observations probably show, you can probably recognize that people self-enhance a lot. What they share in these social spaces is not an accurate representation of their overall life. It is an enhanced version of their life. We can probably imagine things that different kinds of Mormons do to engage in this kind of self-enhancement. Mormons in the church, they take a lot of pride in their callings, their kind of visibility in church, that kind of stuff. Ex-Mormons love to think about how smart they are and that kind of stuff. So there's a whole bunch of ways that we self-enhance because it's important to feel like we're important, we matter, we have thoughts that matter and that kind of stuff. As you might imagine, there is a very strong reaction when you feel like you don't matter. I mean, Black Lives Matter is a very powerful social movement that came out of this sense that some people, some social groups didn't matter, that they didn't have this feeling that they were important, that other people didn't believe that they were important. This tendency to feel like we need to matter is related to our kind of those social identity belonging processes we talked about before, right? We are motivated to really enhance the positive qualities of the groups that we belong to, and really enhance the degree to which we think that our group is important, that our group is righteous, that our group has something valuable to contribute to society, and we're really motivated to think that other groups don't have that. And when you change groups, so when I left the church, for example, my motivation changed from being motivated to think that Mormons were the best to motivated to think that ex-Mormons were the best, right? And I do believe that there's some things better about being an ex-Mormon, otherwise I wouldn't believe that, right? But the point is that I don't necessarily have an objective handle on how good I actually am or how good my group actually is, right? We have very deep existential concerns that we really need met. We humans are aware that we're going to die someday. That can be a very threatening experience to have, a very threatening feeling to have. And it's really important and very motivating to have some answers, to figure out some way that our death isn't as threatening, that there's a reason that we have to go through what we're going through here on Earth right now. And if you look through history for millennia, you'll see story after story about that give people an answer about where they came from, why they're here, and where they're going. And threats to that, somebody suggesting that your way of understanding your purpose might be wrong, is incredibly threatening. And we do all sorts of things to prevent that because, again, related to our other need for accurate knowledge, we want to believe not only that we matter, but the way we understand why we matter is the right way to understand why we matter. And to acknowledge otherwise would be incredibly distressing. And so we try to avoid it. We're motivated to avoid those kinds of experiences. The last social motive I want to talk about is trust. Trust helps us function and survive. And so this is a very, again, very fundamental idea that because we're social creatures, we live in social groups, we share space with other beings, trust is something that helps us function and survive in those spaces. I have a favorite story to tell about a trip my dad and I took to South America when I was a teenager. We were taking a bus from Brazil to Uruguay, and we crossed the border a little too late. We missed the bus on the other side in Uruguay, and we didn't have a place to stay that night. And it was already pretty late, and we were like, okay, what are we going to do? By chance, some kid came up to us and asked us if we needed any help. We said, yeah, we're looking for a place to stay. And it was kind of instinct for us. We asked, is there an LDS church around or something like that? The kid knew where an LDS church was. He helped us track down the bishop of that church. We talked to the bishop. My dad showed the bishop his temple recommend, and that bishop let two strangers stay in his house that night. And so it speaks to the usefulness of this trust. Like, if we can build communities in which we experience that kind of trust, that's tremendously useful and very appealing, like something that we would be motivated to work towards and very motivated to avoid losing. It may not seem that way, but we're so naturally inclined to trust other people that it feels very aversive, very unpleasant when people deceive us. We will also do a whole bunch of things to avoid feeling like our world isn't generally trustworthy. So when trust is breached, we'll do a variety of things to help maintain this sense that most people or the people I care about are trustworthy. One example, one tragic example, is their tendency to blame victims in situations of harm, right? And why that happens, at least one explanation for why that happens, is because somebody in our group, somebody we care about, may have been responsible for harming someone else. And to acknowledge that means also to acknowledge that some of the people that you care about, some of the people that are part of your important social group, may not be as trustworthy as you once thought. That's incredibly unpleasant to think about, very distressing to handle. And so what might be easier is to reframe the situation that the person who got harmed deserved it in some way. And so again, this is incredibly tragic and leads to a lot of the harm that we see in kind of religious communities in a variety of different ways. It's often easier to do these little changes in how we think about others than to upend our whole worldview, right? To finish our discussion of these social motives, I wanted to talk about one example of when our social motives sometimes compete, and one motive outweighs another. This is a classic social psychology study, the Ash Line or Ash Conformity study. And in this study, what happens is they would bring a single research participant into a room full of actors, Confederates. And once in that room, they would be asked to judge the length of lines. So they would be asked to choose from the lines on the right, which line matched the line on the left. And the research participant was the last one to make this judgment, and all the actors would choose one of the obviously incorrect lines. And what the researchers were interested in is how people responded. And a surprising proportion, like a very large proportion of participants, would eventually start conforming to what the rest of the group said. And so this is an example of when your need for accurate knowledge conflicts with your need for belonging, and your need for belonging wins out. And this is a low-stakes situation. So it changes a little bit when the stakes are higher. But this is a low-stakes situation, but people are so motivated not to seem like the odd one that they will change their view, at least temporarily, they will change their view of what they think reality is so that they don't seem like the odd one out. You can imagine a lot of ways that this plays out with different kinds of Mormon experiences, how attached you are to the group that you belong to, how important it is in that moment whether you have or express accurate knowledge, and you can imagine a whole bunch of different kinds of interactions in that kind of situation. With all of these social motives kind of briefly explained, what I'm hoping we're getting from this is the sense that there's a lot going on behind the scenes in any behavior that we observe, any kinds of thoughts or attitudes that we think other people have. A lot of it is much more fundamental than we really give it credit for most of the time. In that sense, very much more understandable than we often give it credit for. And it's also, again, I want to remind everybody that this applies to each of us as well. And so with that in mind, I wanted to revisit some of those differences we talked about before. Again, I don't have the exact solution for why any of these differences exist, but I want us to think a little bit about how some of these variety of factors might play into some of these differences. So start with a really trivial one, right? Did you drink Coke or just caffeinated sodas or dark sodas or whatever the boundary condition of that rule was? Did you do that or not? How serious an offense was it? If you believe differently about it, why did you believe differently about it than other people? And it's probably as simple as, like, this is the social environment you were exposed to growing up, either drank or didn't drink it. The social environment you were exposed to took it seriously or didn't. It's likely that Canadian Mormons and Utah Mormons and California Mormons and European Mormons may have interpreted this kind of thing a little bit differently. And what that is evidence of to me is that it's not as simple as this is the teaching. It's like this is the teaching in a broader social context, right? To get a more serious example, like think about the way that different kinds of Mormons interpret teachings about LGBT individuals, right? I mean, how do you feel LGBT folks should be treated based on what the church says? Some people choose to leave the church based on that information. Some people choose to stay. Some gay people choose to stay in the church despite those teachings that might, to others, seem like excellent reasons to leave, right? Again, what that illustrates is that there are different ways of interpreting that information, and in light of these social motives we've talked about, different reasons why you might interpret that information differently. Remember that we are tremendously motivated to avoid rejection. We're tremendously motivated to maintain a belief that this group that we're a part of that is really important to us is a positive part of our lives. We're highly motivated to think that we have an accurate view of the world, that we can interpret this correctly. And so that can help explain why people look at the same information and interpret it in so many different ways. It's not as simple as just you're misunderstanding or you're a self-hating gay person or something like that. It's way more complicated than that. Another kind of a reference to the difference. If you would just read blank, you would get it, right? And so I think a strong tendency we have is to explain that as like, oh, you're dumb. You are incapable of understanding this objectively true information that I'm going to share, right? But what I hope we can recognize now is that it's more complicated, that there are social motives involved, that we want to believe that we have accurate information. So a Mormon reading the CES letter is going to interpret that information in a way that helps them maintain their belief that they have accurate information. Likewise, for non-Mormons reading Mormon material, right? So it's more complicated than just someone's intelligence or receptiveness to information. Indifference and willingness to harm. I talk to a lot of friends who dislike having conversations with different kinds of Mormons. So some devout Mormons who hate having conversations with former Mormons about religion. Lots of former Mormons dislike having conversations with devout Mormons about religion, that kind of stuff. And often it's because they have the sense that the other group doesn't care about them, that they're very willing to call names and to insult. They claim to be nice people, but here they are calling me names and insulting my belief system, right? It is an inconsistency, absolutely. But thinking about it in terms of these social motives, right? Our sense of belonging. The group that we belong to, we've enhanced to a point where what we have to say is really important. The groups that we don't belong to, we have derogated to a point where what they have to say and what they believe isn't important. So it's okay for me to treat them poorly, or it's okay for me to call them names or insult their intelligence in the purpose of this noble cause that I am advancing, right? To get even more serious, right? How we treat LGBT individuals, how we treat children within the Mormon context. And it's really hard to understand sometimes why, I mean, for people who see harm happening, why people seem to be so indifferent, why people seem to not care. I'm not excusing harm that happens, right? But it's not as simple as saying that they just don't care what happens. It's probably more along the lines of they care deeply about what happens to the people in their lives. They care deeply about what happens to children. They care deeply about what happens to their loved ones. But when weighed against, like, what it would mean to admit that their actions or inaction is causing harm to people that they care about, I mean, that's a huge step to take. Not to say that I don't think people should take it. I absolutely think people should take it. But it is a lot harder than I think we often treat it as to make that change from believing that you're ecclesiastical leaders are inspired of God, that they are meant to protect you and your families and your congregation. It's a big step to go from that belief to something else, right? So there are these strong social motives making us interpret this kind of stuff in different ways. And then just in general, the kind of hypocrisy things, it's really easy to notice times when what they teach, whether it's unconditional love, whether it's caring for the unfortunate among us or whatever, and then seeing them behave in different ways, it's really easy to see those things and be like, oh, such hypocrites. They're terrible people. They obviously don't take their beliefs seriously or something like that. But again, we can think about it in terms of that need for accurate knowledge. Like, what would it mean to admit that they're wrong about something? What would it mean to admit that the group that is very important to them has done something inconsistent with their beliefs? And so we have all these reasons, all these motives to reinterpret these apparent inconsistencies in how we treat people, how we behave, how we think about others. This affects all of us. Everybody in this room, everybody who's never heard a lick of social psychology, even expert social psychologists, I don't know if I have been particularly convincing that this stuff is important, but it was very convincing to me when I was learning about it. And I thought that social psychologists of all people should be really good at kind of noticing, being aware of these motives and changing their behavior accordingly. But it turns out that they're not. I think that sometimes they're better than others, but there's a lot of ways in which they don't really acknowledge or think about this stuff or enact this stuff in their daily lives. So they might know it, but there's reasons why they don't change their thoughts or behavior to be in accordance with it. There's a big movement in social psychology right now about the kind of the replication crisis, what it's called. So old studies are not being reproduced, so old findings are kind of not playing out like they used to. There's a lot of criticisms about bad methodology being used. It has become kind of a conflict between the old guard or the traditional social psychologists and the new upcoming social psychologists, the open science advocates. And so social psychologists are forming groups around how they believe social psychology should work. They are developing close ties to these groups. These groups are really important. These groups are doing something that matters. And therefore, they start thinking differently about the groups that they belong to and the other groups. The other groups are kind of just dumb, stuck in their ways kind of people, right? So social psychologists aren't immune. I'm not immune. If you come up to me after this talk and challenge any of my ideas, I will absolutely get defensive. I like to think that I am self-aware enough that I'm not going to respond with anger. But I will absolutely get defensive. And it's because these are ideas that I care a lot about. These are ideas that I've poured a lot of my life into. It's important to me that I'm sharing accurate information with you. And if you suggest that what I have shared is not accurate or not useful, I will absolutely feel a little defensive. It goes without saying, but none of you are immune either. Even if you feel like you've learned a lot from this talk, you are still going to be subject to these motives, right? These deep-seated social motives that drive our behavior. So compassion and understanding are hard. and understandably hard. There are very legitimate reasons why it's hard to feel positively towards other people who believe differently than us, who do Mormonism differently than us. It's very hard to understand. And because we have limited information, we rarely have the full picture of what explains somebody else's behavior. I happen to think that an appreciation of more of these complex human motives can help us feel a little bit more compassion, feel a little bit more understanding towards other people. Again, doesn't mean approving of other kinds of behavior, but just more understanding of, realizing that it's not as simple as saying that somebody's crazy, dumb, or evil as a way to explain their behavior. There's a lot of stuff going on, a lot of stuff that applies to you and your beliefs at the same time and in the same way. To really drive home how normal all this stuff is that I've talked about. So even when it results in behavior and thoughts and attitudes that we disagree with, maybe that we find repulsive, that the motives driving this behavior are really, really normal. And they are really, really potent and powerful. It's not unusual for people to be motivated to belong to a group and avoid rejection. It's not strange when people do mental contortions to maintain a consistent view of themselves and the world. It's not unusual when people join groups and feel very strongly connected to those groups and treat their out-groups differently. It's not unusual. What is unusual is when we interrupt those processes. So people like, I think, Sunstone attendees are probably more accustomed to this kind of changing these processes, interrupting these very natural, very normal processes. So I want us to keep that in mind, right? Like, it's unusual to challenge these things. It's difficult to challenge these things. We're probably likely to self-enhance and be like, oh, I know this and I'm a better person now, right? But again, keep it in mind, like, it's all part of these motivations that we have. This Sunstone group, if it's important to us, we're going to think about it in certain ways. These motives are everywhere. They're very powerful. They're very normal. And I think a greater appreciation of how these social factors influence beliefs and behavior can help us feel more compassion and more understanding about the other Mormons in our lives, whatever they are. Thank you very much.